Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Eric Molvar. He's a wildlife biologist and directs Wild Earth Guardian's Sagebrush Sea Campaign from an office in Laramie, Wyoming. He's been working on sage grouse conservation issues for the past 14 years. So can you tell me, I guess let's just start by asking, what is a sage grouse? Who is a sage grouse?
Well, the sage grouse is a fairly large bird, about the size of a duck, that lives out in the sagebrush deserts of the Rocky Mountain West. And they're very famous for coming together every spring for these fantastic and intriguing mating displays where the males will come into a central place called a lek, which is usually a clearing in the sagebrush, and will puff out their neck feathers, which are brilliant white, and expand little throat sacs to make a little plopping sound, and shake their tail feathers, which fan out into a spiky array of mottled brown and white. So it's really quite a fascinating display, and it makes them kind of an icon of the wide open spaces of the American West.
And what can you tell me about how common were they and how common are they? I've read that there were 100 years ago, there were like 15 million or 16 million, and they have, like so many creatures have, they've gotten pretty hammered.
That's true. Before the time of Euro-American settlement, there were explorers who recorded flocks of sage grouse that literally darkened the skies and blotted out the sun. And there's certainly nothing like that in terms of numbers of sage grouse today. There are also records in western Colorado of market hunters going out with wagons and filling entire wagon boxes full of the carcasses of sage grouse from a day's hunting, where today, if you go out into these same areas, you're lucky to see one or two birds. Today, across the range of the sage grouse, there are no more than 250 to 450 sage grouse left in the entire United States across an 11-state area that spans the Rocky Mountain states of Montana, Wyoming, and Colorado, and works its way west through the Great Basin all the way out to northeastern California and central Washington.
Wait, how many did you say? How many birds are left?
Between 250 and 450,000.
Okay. And what are some of the causes of the decline, apart from filling entire wagons full of dead birds?
Well, certainly any kind of human development in sage grouse country is going to have a negative impact on sage grouse. And before we even had the last 50 years worth of decline, there was the settlement of the American West, which meant that the valley bottoms were often converted into irrigated hay fields, and towns were platted, roads were put in, and all of these things had a negative impact on sage grouse. And then the last 50 years, oil and gas development on the eastern half of the range in the Intermountain West states has had a really severe and catastrophic impact on sage grouse populations. And as you move west, more westward into the Great Basin states of Nevada, Idaho, Utah, and Oregon, livestock grazing and the invasion of cheatgrass, which is an invasive weed, have had a catastrophic effect on sage grouse habitat, by essentially converting native sagebrush grassland into broad spans of invasive cheatgrass, which moves in following overgrazing. And then that cheatgrass burns on a 2 to 4 year cycle, which means when you have these range fires, sagebrush doesn't come back after a wildfire. It doesn't sprout from its roots like some of the other shrubs do. And as a consequence, when you have a wildfire move through the area, it wipes out the sagebrush, and it can take up to 150 years for that sagebrush to come in again at a density and maturity that's going to be useful habitat for the grouse.
And why/how is the oil and gas, putting in the oil and gas facilities, how does that harm them?
Well, when you start drilling an oil and gas field, you start fragmenting the habitat with a network of roads and wells and pipelines, which means that what was once a broad expanse of sagebrush habitat uninterrupted by human intrusions is suddenly broken up into smaller and smaller fragments. But it's not necessarily the loss of the habitat itself that's the biggest problem. The biggest problem is whenever you have an oil and gas field put in, you're going to have to a heavy amount of truck traffic that's going back to the well sites to haul away condensate and other waste products, to check the well sites every day. You're going to have human activity at individual well locations. And all of this human activity causes sage grouse to abandon the lands that are within 2 miles on either side of any road or well site. And so as a consequence, when the oil and gas industry moves in, the sage grouse move out. And when you have a standard oil and gas well field where you have, say, 4 well sites per square mile and the pipelines and roads that go with that, there is no location in that well field that's going to be more than 2 miles from a road. So that entire area is going to be avoided by sage grouse. And what was once really important habitat will have been converted to a sort of a silent sagebrush steppe with no sage grouse left.
You said that they don't like being within 2 miles of a road?
That's correct.
And how many places in Wyoming, for example, even Wyoming, I mean, how many places outside of wilderness areas are there still 2 miles that don't have, I mean, how many places are left that still don't have roads for 2 miles in any direction? That seems like, even Wyoming, I can't imagine that there are a lot of places that are that removed from roads.
Well, Wyoming is the least populated state in the Union, but even here, you would be surprised how few areas out in the sagebrush basins that there are that are actually 2 miles from a road. And so, as a consequence, the remaining sagebrush habitat that we have is already being impacted by that density of roads that's out there that is depressing sage grouse numbers. And they've really gotten to the point where they have nowhere left to go. They have no choice but to live within 2 miles of roads. And so when they live in these areas, they experience things like lower reproductive success, lower adult survival, and that leads to this trend of declining populations over time, which is exactly what we're seeing today.
A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Khan Slobachikov about prairie dogs. And one of the things he was saying about prairie dogs is that their lives are really closely intertwined with many other species of plants and animals. And is that true for sage grouse too? Are they, I mean, obviously it's true for everybody, but what are some of the relationships that they have with other members of their biotic community?
Well, prairie dogs are what is known as a keystone species, which means that if you take away the prairie dog, you're going to take away dozens of other types of wildlife that depend on the prairie dog for food and for habitat, for homes or nest sites. And so they are the linchpin of the entire ecosystem. The sage grouse is a different kind of species called an umbrella species, which means that because the sage grouse requires large tracts of undeveloped and unimpacted sagebrush habitat, by saving the sage grouse, it requires saving large areas of remaining undisturbed habitat that will also support hundreds of other kinds of sagebrush wildlife and plants. And so while the sage grouse is itself not a keystone like the prairie dog, in other words, if you subtracted the sage grouse from the ecosystem, you wouldn't have ecosystem collapse. But by protecting the sage grouse, you can protect an entire ecosystem and most all of the species that require those same sagebrush habitats. And those include things like white-tailed prairie dogs and pygmy rabbits, burrowing owls, and brewer sparrows, some of these other inhabitants of the sagebrush steppe that cannot move on to other kinds of habitats if we do destroy those sagebrush basins out in the American West.
I want to go back for a second. This is still on the same topic of their relationship with other species, but you would think that reducing numbers from 15 million to 250 to 400,000 would have a huge effect on those who eat them. And I'm wondering who eats sage grouse, and so who has suffered because of that loss?
Well, there are a number of different species that eat sage grouse as adults. And on the land-based mammal side of things, you have such animals as swift foxes, coyotes, skunks, badgers, even in some cases, ground squirrels will take the eggs of sage grouse when they can get them. And then, even more importantly, perhaps as an impact to sage grouse, you have birds of prey like hawks and eagles, and also ravens are an important nest predator. And so all of these species will lose part of their food supply when you lose a sage grouse population. Some of these, like coyotes and ravens, are generalist predators, and they're able to switch onto other different kinds of prey when one form of prey goes away. Others, such as some of the hawks and eagles, are much more narrowly focused on and specialist on certain prey types. And so when you lose some of the prey items, whether it be sage grouse or prairie dogs, you also start to see declines in their populations. And that's what we are indeed seeing in some of the bigger raptors and swift foxes.
The ravens makes me think of a plan by Idaho to continue with putting in oil and gas, but to kill ravens because they're essentially blaming the ravens for the decline in sage grouse. Do you want to comment? Do I have that correct? And B, do you want to comment on that?
Well, in Idaho, it wasn't so much that they wanted the oil and gas to continue, but they wanted livestock raising to continue at present levels. And there are only two active oil and gas well sites in the state of Idaho, so it's really not as big an issue there as it is in places like Wyoming, where you might have well fields that are thousands of wells in dimension. Now, the problem with blaming ravens is that ravens really are not the cause of the sage grouse decline. They're really more of a symptom. And if you're out there with livestock and you're grazing down the grasses between the sagebrush plants, then the sage grouse have nowhere left to hide. And sage grouse are very slow flyers. They prefer to run around to avoid predators and hide. And camouflage is their strongest defense. Avoiding detection is really how sage grouse go about their lives and are able to evade the predators that are seeking them out. If you graze down the grasses to a level that's lower than 7 inches, then the sage grouse no longer have enough grass cover between the sagebrush shrubs to hide from their predators, and you see an increase in the predation rate. The ranchers like to blame that on the predators because the predators are what are approximately killing the sage grouse. But the real blame lies with livestock overgrazing and irresponsible levels of cattle and sheep out on the range that are grazing down the grass to a level at which you no longer have sufficient hiding cover for your sage grouse. And basically, it's like going into a dressing room and pulling aside the curtain. The actresses have nowhere to hide.
So I want to go back to what you were talking about at the very, very beginning with the well, actually, what I would like to do is talk about you for a second. And why do you care so much about sage grouse? What is it about them that attracts you? And I mean, tell me how that love affair with them began.
Well, I didn't come into the conservation community to work on sage grouse originally. I came in originally to work on wilderness issues. And when I started working in Wyoming, in the big sagebrush basins where so many of the endangered wilderness candidates were found, the biggest impact out there was oil and gas development. And there really wasn't anything that was stopping it or even slowing it down or even forcing the companies to drill in a way that was responsible or to minimize their environmental impact. It was pretty much a free-for-all, and it still is today. The sage grouse was the one species that seemed to hold the key to slowing down a fossil fuel industry that has run amok across the American West for decades. And this is an industry that is so accustomed to doing everything it wants, wherever it wants, whenever it wants, in the most destructive way that it wants, that it believes that nothing can stop it. And now comes along the sage grouse, which occupies the exact same sagebrush basins that the oil and gas industry covets. And the sage grouse needs vast tracts of wild and untamed landscapes to survive. And so you can't have these train wreck oil and gas fields with 4 or 8 or 12 or 64 wells per square mile in the same areas where you're going to have sage grouse. So in the years of working on oil and gas and energy issues in the West, it finally dawned on me that the sage grouse possibly was the one thing that held the possibility of saving the American West from being completely overrun by the fossil fuels industry.
Well, first, thank you for your work. And next, you know, when I grew up in Colorado and so spent a fair amount of time in all the western states, including Wyoming. And my recollection of Wyoming as a child back in the late 60s, early 70s was of pretty vast, wide open spaces. And I haven't been back to Wyoming since probably the mid to early 80s. And the photographs I've seen and also the stories I've heard from people is that Wyoming has been completely transformed by the oil and gas industry. And yes, they were there before, but that's really accelerated in the last 30 years.
When I came down to Wyoming in 2000, the conservation community really wasn't even working much on oil and gas issues. We were focused more on logging and clear cutting and forest fragmentation up on national forest lands, and nobody was paying much attention to what was happening out in the sagebrush basins because the level of oil and gas development that was out there was pretty small, it was scattered, it was isolated. It didn't represent a major environmental threat at that time. And then when the Bush administration took office in 2000, they essentially handed the reins of the Bureau of Land Management over to the oil and gas industry. And it became an unprecedented free-for-all of industrial activity out in basins that were once vast and untouched. Suddenly these places became transformed into these industrial landscapes with well pads and roads and pipelines and all manner of heavy industrial traffic and activity, drilling rigs with huge diesel engines, air pollution, dust pollution, an unimaginable transformation of a state that was once known for its wide open spaces and rural remote character, and then became more aptly characterized as an industrial sacrifice zone. And this is what we have seen over the past 10 years. And having learned the lessons of that loss here in Wyoming, it's imperative that we learn how to do oil and gas development in a much, much different way if we're going to continue with this harmful fossil fuel extraction at all.
So as a longtime activist myself in the West, I have fought against ranchers, in many ways for 30 years. And are you finding that the ranchers are good allies or not in terms of good temporary allies or not in terms of fighting the oil and gas industry?
In some cases, ranchers can be very effective allies to conservationists in terms of fighting off oil and gas proposals. And there are a number of examples where ranchers have become very outspoken critics of the way that oil and gas development is proceeding and also have called for much more environmentally responsible oil and gas development. In some other areas, there has been a sort of a closing of ranks between the agriculture industry and the energy industry, where they all look at the possibility of environmental protection as the common feared outcome that might limit either of their aspirations for profits and profitability. And so it really varies by location. One of the things that was most striking to me was looking at how oil coal bed methane development happened in the Powder River Basin, where federal agencies controlled all of the fluid minerals underneath, but private landowners had ranches and private lands on the surface. And what we found was that the ranchers that were being drilled would suddenly become environmental activists and would be outspoken critics of the oil and gas industry, would fight very hard to try and restore the lost values of their ranches. And it got so bad in many ranches that, you know, livestock were poisoned by tainted water. The dust caused a sort of form of dust pneumonia for the cattle. The ranchers could no longer run their cattle and have a profitable operation. And even in some cases, could no longer sell their land because it became essentially worthless, having become an industrial sacrifice zone. And yet, right across the fence in a neighboring undeveloped pasture, another rancher nearby might still be supporting the oil and gas industry and unable to see that the fate that had just befallen his next-door neighbor and had ruined the ranching prospects in that area was coming next to a landscape near him. And it's amazing to me that it took the direct, not just the immediate threat of oil and gas development, but the direct impact of oil and gas development coming onto a rancher's land to make that rancher understand how devastating oil and gas development could be, not just for wildlife, not just for lands and habitat, but even for ranching.
Yeah, I think our ability, our individual and collective ability to remain in denial, I think is pretty overwhelming. So what are some of the tools? I know that when I, for example, and you're talking about stopping clear cuts and fighting the Forest Service, I know that some of the tools we used were timber sale appeals, lawsuits. Those were some of them. What are some of the tools that you use to protect sage grouse?
Well, sage grouse conservation begins first and foremost with the Endangered Species Act, because before the sage grouse was petitioned for endangered species protection back in the early 2000s, none of the state and federal agencies were paying any attention at all to sage grouse conservation. Once that threat of Endangered Species Act listing got on the table and agencies started realizing that they were going to lose their permitting authority to the Fish and Wildlife Service because the protections of the Endangered Species Act would prevent them from doing business as usual, that really got a lot of attention at the federal level, at the state level, and also at the local level. So the local government started scrambling to engage in random acts of conservation to try and demonstrate that they were doing something, anything, to protect the sage grouse. The states eventually started to draw up some state plans, and the federal government started to overhaul all of its federal land use plans on Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management lands all over the West, and that's underway right now. And that could protect millions of acres of potential sage grouse habitat from future oil and gas drilling. It could force there to be a reform of grazing practices to radically reduce perhaps the amount of livestock that are put out there to graze down the grasses that the sage grouse need for hiding cover, and could affect a number of other things that are having a negative impact on sage grouse, such as transmission line development or subdivisions. Now, when you get right down to individual projects and plans, the tools that helped activists fight the timber industry back in the 1970s and 80s, the appeals and litigation, are still the most effective types of actions to protect sage grouse today. And I'll give you a couple of examples. The Bureau of Land Management in each state four times a year has an oil and gas lease auction. And Wild Earth Guardians and its partner groups have been able to actually get the BLM in most states to not offer any sage grouse priority habitat acreage for leases in these auctions. In Wyoming, a recent news report has said that those deferrals from the lease auction in Wyoming alone totaled 3.5 million acres of public land. Those are acres that would have been leased to the oil and gas industry for industrial development and instead remain unleased because of the sage grouse. Another example is that we are using the federal agency's lack of study of impacts to sage grouse to keep them from approving projects that have not been fully studied and whose impacts haven't been fully assessed. The National Environmental Policy Act, which is one of the nation's bedrock environmental laws, requires a number of things. It requires that you involve public participation and listen to public comments and respond to them. It requires that you look before you leap and you examine the environmental consequences and impacts of the project you're proposing. And it requires that you look at a range of alternatives, including environmentally more responsible alternatives to development. Now, within this context, the federal government is required to take account of all significant new information. And given the number of different kinds of primitive activities that are known to have significant impacts on sage-grouse, that means that you cannot have a new project in sage-grouse country that's going to have a potentially significant impact unless you have a full-scale environmental impact statement, which is a pretty thorough review. In many cases, the Bureau of Land Management and Forest Service like to rely upon or tier back forest plans or the land management plans that these agencies have, and to basically say, well, back in 1982, we looked at these impacts and we studied these significant impacts, and therefore that EIS, that environmental impact statement that we did back in 1982, is sufficient to support oil and gas leasing today, or an oil and gas project today, without doing a full-scale environmental impact statement. Well, the fact of the matter is that most of the science that has emerged about impacts of industrial projects and livestock grazing on sage-grouse has come out in the last 10 years. And there's a wealth of new information that the federal government hadn't considered back in the 1980s and 90s. Things like the adding of the sage-grouse to the candidate species list under the Endangered Species Act. Things like many different kinds of scientific publications revealing, for instance, impacts of various levels of noise to sage-grouse that were unknown even 5 years ago. The recommendations of the federal government's own national technical team that were published in 2011 wouldn't have been considered back in the 80s and 90s. And so consequently, one of the things that environmentalists can do is to point out that a full-scale environmental review is going to be required to evaluate the site-specific impacts of every single kind of activity that's going to have a major impact on sage-grouse. And that can really cause the federal government to have to slow down the pace of these destructive types of projects.
I know that in the forests, one of the things, one of the tactics used by the industry has been, I mean, of course, what everything you're saying is applicable to stopping clear cutting, stopping a lot of grazing. In terms of, there would be very few timber sales that would actually be put out by the federal government if they actually had to follow all the current laws, and so. We would appeal, saying you're violating NEPA or NIFMA or whatever, and win. And part of the response was, at least part of the response to people doing this all across the country, was in the 1990s, was a salvage rider, which basically said that they could do anything. They had such emergencies that they could override environmental protection. So what has been the industry response to the industry and BLM and Forest Service response to you attempting to force the BLM to follow federal laws?
Well, right now, the federal agency's response has been fairly constructive, which is that they've put on hold most, if not all, projects that are happening in the most important sage-grouse habitats until their big land management plan revision process is completed. So that's actually been a productive thing. And while the oil and gas industry likes to say that, oh, well, if the sage-grouse were ever to be put on the endangered species list, it would be a catastrophe for the United States economy, right now we have 3 years of history where the BLM essentially is putting oil and gas projects and leasing on hold in these sage-grouse priority habitats already, as if the bird were listed. And the economic catastrophe that was forecast simply isn't happening because they're going into areas that aren't important to sage-grouse and doing plenty of oil and gas drilling. Now, the response of the oil and gas industry and the cattlemen's associations to the sage-grouse protection issue has been very different. They've been fighting tooth and nail to try and prevent the listing of the sage-grouse under the Endangered Species Act and to try and obstruct the federal agencies from applying strong and science-based protections in these new plans. And they're even going so far as to have right-wing politicians in Congress introduce bills to delay or deny the protections of the Endangered Species Act to sage-grouse and other species in order to prevent from having to change the way that they do business in key sage-grouse habitats.
And is there a chance that any of those bills will succeed?
In the immediate term, most of those bills seem fairly dead on arrival. It is certainly true that very little is passing through Congress in these days of gridlock. And yet, at the same time, if the political makeup of the Congress were to shift to the right in a more in a pro-industry way, there is nothing necessarily to prevent the dismantling of the Endangered Species Act or any of our other environmental laws. And indeed, we've seen some weakening of environmental laws when the winds of politics change. For example, in 2005, the Republicans controlled both the presidency and also both houses of Congress, and they passed what was called the Energy Policy Act of 2005. And one of the things that it did was that it exempted hydraulic fracturing or fracking from the protections of the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act, which means that you can pollute as much water as you want with fracking, and there's nothing that can legally be done about it. And there's no responsibility to prevent the pollution of these aquifers. So these kinds of congressional disasters are very possible and could indeed come to pass if there are major political shifts in an anti-environmental direction. And that's something that conservation groups are keenly aware of and are working very hard to educate the public.
So what do you see for give me a couple three scenarios. I know that the crystal ball is always cloudy, but give me a couple three scenarios for the short to midterm future for sage grouse.
Well, one possible scenario is that the federal agencies could look at their own experts' recommendations, that National Technical Team report, where state and federal sage-grouse experts came together and recommended all kinds of very specific and measurable limits on development in key sage-grouse habitats that would allow the bird to survive and recover. If the federal government were to implement these recommendations on the public lands, and the state and local governments also put in place strong and reliable and science-based protections for their part of the sage-grouse habitat, then the populations of sage-grouse would likely rebound and an endangered species listing might not be necessary. Another possible scenario would be that the federal government continues along the track that it's going along now, where it's trying to do some things for sage-grouse, but to build in all kinds of loopholes into the sage-grouse protections that prevent the protection of sage-grouse habitat when it comes down to an oil and gas project or any other kind of industrial project being applied in sage-grouse priority habitats. And if that happens, then the Fish and Wildlife Service, which has already ruled that the federal agencies have inadequate regulatory mechanisms, and that's a threat to the species' survival, then we're going to have possibly the Fish and Wildlife Service list the sage-grouse as threatened or endangered under the Endangered Species Act, which is going to mean that the protections that are applied aren't only going to apply in these discrete priority habitats that have been identified by scientists, but they're going to be applied everywhere where there are sage-grouse and sage-grouse habitat. So it'll have a much broader brush level of protection. A third possibility is that the federal agencies might again compromise on sage-grouse protection and not give them the protection they need to survive, and the Fish and Wildlife Service, through political pressure, could possibly cave in and not list the bird, at which point there is an abundant record out there of failures of conservation measures specific to the kinds of things that the federal agencies are even proposing today that would enable conservation groups to litigate the failure to list the sage-grouse and to force the sage-grouse onto the list through litigation. And that could be a possible end game if the Fish and Wildlife Service does what it's tasked to do, which is decide if the sage-grouse is still warranted today as it was in 2010 when they initially added it to the candidate species list. It's going to be very difficult for the Fish and Wildlife Service to make a finding that the sage-grouse is not warranted today in 2015 when they're required to do so by law, if the sage-grouse populations are much lower than they were in 2010 when it made its initial listing ruling. And that's where we are. That's where we do, in fact, stand today with sage-grouse populations that are significantly smaller in every state than they were in 2010.
So they're significantly smaller just in the last 4 years.
There has been, since 2007, range-wide, there has been a very significant decrease in sage-grouse populations in every state where the sage-grouse live. In Wyoming, for example, there has been almost a 60% decline in sage-grouse.
Some of this,
critics argue, would be part of the cyclic nature of ups and downs of sage-grouse population, but undoubtedly also the impacts of livestock grazing and some of the oil and gas development in sage-grouse habitats that's ongoing outside of the priority habitats is making a major contribution to the decline as well.
So we have a couple minutes left, and we've got like 4 or 5 minutes left, and what would you want for people to do, both people who live in affected areas? So there's two different questions. What would you like for people to do who live in areas where the sage grouse exist? And what would you want for people who don't live in those areas to do? How can either one of those categories help protect the sage grouse?
Well, people who live in sage grouse country can become active in advocating for the protection of sage-grouse habitats and demanding that their local and state officials put in the kinds of protections that are required by the science that we know that the sage-grouse need to survive. And right now, Western political leaders of both parties are dragging their feet on sage-grouse conservation, and they need a swift kick in the pants. And local residents in sage-grouse country are just the people to deliver that swift kick in the pants.
And how would one deliver that swift... You know, let's say I live in Casper, Wyoming, or I live in northeastern California, or I live in eastern Oregon, or wherever. How would I deliver that? What would I do?
One of the most effective ways to do this is to write a letter in your local newspaper and have it published as a letter to the editor, where you identify the problems that are affecting sage-grouse and the failures of local and state officials in addressing these problems, and come and bring this to light so that there's nowhere to hide. Politicians hate to have the spotlight placed on them when they're not doing anything to solve the problem. And so once the public starts speaking out on behalf of sage-grouse, and there are any number of reasons to do that, one doesn't have to be a sage-grouse lover to want to protect sage-grouse habitat. If you're a big game hunter and you like mule deer or elk, the winter ranges that these species require are also sage-grouse habitat. If you like going out into the wide open spaces and camping and hiking, these are things that can be protected by protecting the sage grouse. Another thing that can be done, no matter where you live in the United States, is writing a letter by email to your representative in Congress and basically telling them that we need to have some balance in sage grouse country. There needs to be room enough for the sage grouse to survive. We can't just overrun every single acre of habitat with oil and gas wells and excessive stocking rates of livestock so that there's no room left for the sage grouse to have a successful life history. We need to have some room for our native wildlife as well, and our members of Congress need to hear that story.
You know, I live in Crescent City, California, which is in a tiny county, Del Norte, which is, I tend to call the politics here Mississippi on the North Coast, because the politicians are so incredibly reactionary. And the right wing has been completely fabulously effective at organizing to, anytime the local paper prints anything that is remotely objectionable to anybody who is in the basically fascist far, far, far right, there's a spate of letters to the editor responding to it. And the right wing has taken over the library board. They've taken over the waste treatment disposal, the board that's overseeing that. They've done a fabulous job. Like, they take over the Harbor Commission. They take over everything. And this is a big problem, I think, on the left, is that the left has spent a lot of time sort of wringing our hands, or I'm certainly not talking about you, spent a lot of time wringing our hands or sneering at the completely corrupt political system, while the right has been rolling up their sleeves and organizing and getting people put into school boards everything else. And so one of the things I would like to do right now is specifically challenge listeners of this, especially those living in the state. I would like to challenge them to at least, I want to say one more thing first before I challenge them, which is the big distinction is not between those who believe that we need some sort of militant action, those who believe we don't. The big distinction is between those who do something at all and those who do nothing at all, but sit here and sort of complain. And I would like to really challenge listeners of this to, if you live in one of these Western states, to do precisely what you said and write and commit yourself to writing like one letter to the editor per month. I mean, that will only take you, you know, maybe an hour a month. And if you live outside the areas, to do exactly what you said and to write to someone else, that's a really good start. And then once people get started, then they can move from there. But I would really like to challenge people to do exactly what you just said.
I think it's incredibly important for people to be involved in their communities, for people to be involved in the public debate. And remember, the loudest and most passionate voices are what's going to carry the day. And in places where the anti-environmental voices are the loudest and most passionate, and there's no countervailing counterweight from conservation supporters, you can only expect the political winds to blow against conservation and in favor of destructive development.
Well, so is there any concluding message you would like to leave? Any one thing that you would like for people to take away from this interview?
It's worth considering that by saving the sage-grouse and all those millions of acres of prime, undisturbed sage-grouse habitat that we have left in the American West, that we can finally bring the fossil fuel industry and some of these other consumptive and destructive extractive industries into a more modest and moderate level of impact and achieve what has never been achieved before, which is have considerations for wildlife and conservation be equal to considerations for extraction and greed and profit on our Western public lands. And saving the sage-grouse really could be what could save the American West, not just in terms of wildlife habitat, but in terms of open spaces, wild vistas, and recreational destinations.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for your work. And I would like to thank people for listening. My guest today has been Eric Molnar. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.